Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And we will start today with hopefully a more nuanced look at the legacy of George H.W. Bush than many media outlets have been presenting, and how, in many historians' understanding of what happened, Bush was a moderate, yes, in his upbringing and general instincts, but he was also a pivotal figure in acquiescing to the demands of an increasingly angry conservative movement in a way that helped lead the Republican Party to where it is today. And let me say right off the bat that nothing in this hopefully nuanced conversation that's critical of him is to negate the apparent real decency of the man or the strengths in his career or the ways in which he was an earnest public servant, which he was. But let's take a deeper dive on a few things. For example, I went back and poked around at some of the reporting on him from when he was actually in office. And I'm going to read from a New York Times article dated June 9th, 1991. Headline, "When the subject is civil rights, there are two George Bushes," by reporter Stephen A. Holmes. And it says, "George Bush, the man whose presidential campaign benefited from the now notorious Willie Horton commercials, also has the distinction of having appointed the first black chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell. He will be remembered as a president who vetoed a civil rights bill in 1990 while making a point of donating half the proceeds from his autobiography to the United Negro College Fund. Images of Mr. Bush's relations with blacks collide at odd angles, revealing no coherent pattern other than contradiction. And combined with his flip-flops on issues like abortion, voodoo economics, and no new taxes, his approach to race raises a broader question. Is there no coherent pattern or no coherent value system?" And I'm going to continue a little further on in this article. It says, "As a candidate for the Senate from Texas in 1964, Mr. Bush came out against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the landmark law that ended segregated lunch counters, restrooms, movie theaters, and other public accommodations, and made employment discrimination illegal. In the campaign, Mr. Bush said the law was, quote, politically inspired and is bad legislation in that it transcends the Constitution," unquote. Then it says, 3 years ago, that would have been 1988, writing in his autobiography about his successful 1966 race for the House, for the House, Mr. Bush lamented that it was, quote, both puzzling and disappointed that he attracted so few black votes. And the article adds, Mr. Bush didn't mention his opposition to the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. So that was from the New York Times in 1991 when Bush was president. Later that year, 91, he did sign a revised version of the Job Discrimination Civil Rights Bill that he had vetoed in 1990.
I say I am very pleased with your persistence and the fact that we have a piece of civil rights legislation that will guarantee against discrimination in the workplace.
Bush as president in 91. Also, he's getting a lot of credit right now for having led the country into sort of the good Iraq war, also in 1991, after Iraq had invaded its neighbor Kuwait, mostly to seize its oil resources. But that Iraq war was controversial too. For example, Bush got widely criticized on the left for framing his war plans as part of a new world order following the end of the Cold War. New world order sounded principled to some, imperialistic to others. Here's an example from the time as he was talking the country into war.
What is at stake is more than one small country. It is a big idea, a new world order, where diverse nations are drawn together in common cause to achieve the universal aspirations of mankind, peace and security, freedom, and the rule of law. Such is a world worthy of our struggle and worthy of our children's future.
And the war debate was divisive around language like that. Freedom and the rule of law, which he cited there, were more ignored by the Bush administration in countries where we didn't have an oil interest, like we did in Kuwait, big debate at the time. And the war got authorized in the Senate by just a few votes, 53-46. Democrats were overwhelmingly opposed. One no vote in the House was by a young independent congressman from New England.
Mr. Speaker, based on four public hearings that I've held in the state of Vermont, and based on the mail and the telephone calls that my office is receiving, it is my belief that the people of Vermont are overwhelmingly convinced that the crisis in the Persian Gulf can be resolved in a nonviolent manner through the continuation of strong economic sanctions against Iraq.
Congressman Bernie Sanders in 1991. So we'll start there and talk to Rutgers historian David Greenberg, author of the book Republic of Spin and an article in Politico this week called Is History Being Too Kind to George H.W. Bush? And Eleanor Cliff, Daily Beast columnist, who wrote a piece called George H.W. Bush, President, Internationalist, War Hero, Dead at 94, and Juan Williams, Fox News political analyst and author of the new book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. So welcome back, all three of you, to WNYC. Thank you so much for doing this. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Brian.
And let's talk about race first. And I want to spend a good amount of our time on the question of race. Looking back, Juan, why did George Bush oppose the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and why was that inconsistent with his background?
Well, in fact, his father, Prescott Bush, had been a senator and had been very pro-desegregation in Connecticut, one of the leaders of desegregation. But then George H.W. Bush goes down to Texas, and suddenly he's dealing with a far more conservative element there. And in 64, he votes against the Civil Rights Act, and he cites the same rationale being used by Barry Goldwater, which is that I don't have to associate with people if I don't want to. This is America. It's a matter of my privacy, my rights, etc. I think there was an awful quote, Brian, that said something like, you know, this is really standing up for, you know, the black population, 14% of the population. What about the other 86%? Something like that. Of course, he then goes on in 68, I believe, to back the Fair Housing Act, and then has to go down to Houston, and what he said was the best speech of his life, explained to constituents who were opposed why he was standing for equal rights under law for all people without regard to color.
And David, the Times article I read from 1991 said also mentioned that Bush then supported the 1968 Fair Housing Act, but couched that as a change for Bush at a time when that kind of law had become more popular among white Americans. And this goes with the theory in your article that he had a cynical streak, which is not a word we hear used a lot with respect to George H.W. Bush.
Yeah, I look at Bush's career and see a struggle between this more moderate or even liberal republicanism, in some cases, of his patrimony, his father, and New England, and then the more conservative thrust of the Republican Party that was taking over starting in the 60s when he enters politics. And there's kind of a war for his soul. And he often sort of wants to do the right thing, but manages to subordinate that higher desire to a need for short-term political gain. And it's a pattern you again see with abortion, voodoo economics, and so on.
And the Willie Horton ad in his 1988 presidential campaign is getting talked about a lot in the remembrances. And for people who don't know it, it was notable for singling out his opponent, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, for a parole program, even though it was similar to one, or a furlough program like weekend passes, even though it was similar to one that Ronald Reagan had as governor of California. And what got the ad the reputation of being racist was how it featured Willie Horton's face, a shot chosen to look menacing and clearly black as a symbol of fear, accompanied by this soundtrack.
One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
So, Eleanor Cliff, Bush's campaign manager, Lee Atwater, later expressed regrets for that ad. Did Bush ever do so himself, to your knowledge?
I don't believe so. And the way the senior Bush
regarded campaigning. He drew a line between what you had to do to get elected, and I think in his mind he rationalized it was okay because then once you were elected you would govern like a gentleman. And I think in that particular campaign he turned himself over to the consultants, Roger Ailes, Lee Atwater, I think maybe even Roger Stone was involved in that campaign. And he gave them free rein. And he could have pulled back that Willie Horton ad if he chose. I think the campaign said, well, it was a subsidiary group that did it. But he didn't. And he certainly knew that it had created a lot of controversy. It was on the front page of every newspaper. And it really set a tone that put a damper on negative campaigning for a period of time because everybody was afraid they would get that kind of backlash. But it worked. You know, it got him elected. He also went after Dukakis on his patriotism, the card-carrying member of the ACLU, and something that Governor Dukakis had not dictated that school children recite the Pledge of Allegiance every morning. He made a lot out of that as well. So he was a street fighter as a campaigner, but he did make the pivot when he became a president, certainly. And in the inaugural address, when he talked about how he would be kinder and gentler, I think it was Nancy Reagan who then said, "Kinder and gentler than whom?" She thought that was a swipe at her husband, but maybe he was even thinking of himself as a president. He was going to be kinder and gentler than he was as a campaigner.
Interesting. And interesting, too, and I don't want to dwell on this because we're doing a history segment, that Willie Horton style of campaign ad, which, as you say, people were kind of embarrassed to do again for a long time, came back with a vengeance in these midterms in 2018 in a few races without much embarrassment at all. But then he got elected and vetoed the first Civil Rights Act that came to his desk, the Anti-Job Discrimination Bill in 1990, but then he signed the revised version in 1991 as we played that clip. Eleanor, do you happen to know what changed?
I don't, but his rationale for vetoing the first one was that it would open the door to quotas, which was it's like when people argue against climate change and they say, "I'm not a scientist," but I mean, that was the place to go to. Oh, it's quotas, because nobody wanted quotas. And I think maybe they made some adjustments and perhaps that allowed him to then go forward and sign it. And, you know, I do think he was sensitive to the negative reaction. It was a hugely negative reaction when he signed that 1990 bill from women's groups, from civil rights groups, and from everybody who thought that he was this, patrician New England Republican and he would govern in that tradition. This seemed like a very, right-wing, Gingrichian response. And remember, he was president at a time when Gingrich and the right really were coming online. And the president had, President Bush had a fully Democratic Congress his whole 4 years. So he vetoed, I think, something like 40 vetoes. And they were sustained. I think all except for one. So he kept the Republicans together against the Democrats. But if he wanted to accomplish anything, he really did have to strike some sort of a moderate line. So I'd like to think between the first civil rights bill and the second that he saw the light of both politics and also that he was, sensitive to the hugely negative reaction he got with that first veto.
And in 1991, after signing that Civil Rights Act, he nominated Clarence Thomas for the Supreme Court and said this:
"Judge Thomas's life is a model for all Americans, and he's earned the right to sit on this nation's highest court, and I am very proud indeed to nominate him for this position."
So what we always hear, Juan, these days about the Thomas confirmation process is the Anita Hill sexual harassment allegations. But what about nominating such a conservative African-American on race issues, which Thomas was and is, to succeed Thurgood Marshall, of all people? Why did he think that was somehow respectful of Black America?
Well, this is an interesting question, because I think the premise really is that there's a Black seat on the Supreme Court, that Thurgood Marshall had been there, had been established, as the idea that, you could have a Black person on the Supreme Court, Marshall being the first African-American justice. And so here comes Marshall's retirement, and Bush is looking for someone black to put on the court. I think that, you know, he was considering other people, but really wanted a young person, who could stay on the court for many years. Bill Coleman was a well-known Republican, had been Secretary of Transportation in the Ford administration and the like, much well-respected, but older. And the idea was not only that you get a younger person, but that you don't go for a moderate like someone like a Bill Coleman, but that you get someone who has some conservative credentials. And it's interesting to me because I covered this White House that Thomas was often seen as vacillating, Brian, as not strong enough in terms of a lot of the Reagan conservatism, but certainly in terms of the spectrum of black political thought, he was on the right. I mean, it's interesting. Thomas is a guy who's a big follower of Malcolm X, but again, it's sort of black nationalist self-sufficiency, personal responsibility, anger, and he comes out of that, but he was 100% with the conservative agenda when it came to opposition to, for example, quotas that Eleanor mentioned earlier. And so you also get, and we didn't talk about this, Bush's support for the war on drugs, making a famous speech, I believe it was like 89-90, in which a young black man is arrested in Lafayette Square, set up basically, I don't think I'm going off the farm here by saying he was set up by the Secret Service and the police so that Bush could hold up a bag of white crack cocaine, he said in the Oval Office address. And that fed billions into the continuing war on drugs that has had a terrible consequence for so many, but specifically in the black community. And then comes the Thomas nomination, which, again, the idea was to cement in place in that black seat, not a liberal, but in this case, a far-right conservative as a black man.
And yet, Juan, the Times article from 1991 that I read from said he had a positive approval rating among black Americans at the time, over 50%. That was just before the Thomas nomination. Do you know if that changed it or what the source of his popularity among African Americans was, considering everything we've talked about so far?
Oh, yeah. I think that he was seen, you know, in black America as a kind of Connecticut Yankee liberal on civil rights issue. And not only that, unlike what we see from, example, President Trump, he had black people around him. He reached out to black groups. He addressed black groups. There was no sense of, I am going after black America. He seemed to be the kind of Republican that was willing to do business and embrace black America on many levels.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about nuances in the legacy of George H.W. Bush with Juan Williams, who is just speaking there, political analyst for Fox News and author of the book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. David Greenberg, historian of American politics at Rutgers and author of an article now on Politico that asks, is history being too kind to George H.W. Bush? And Eleanor Cliff, Daily Beast, Washington correspondent, who back in that day was, I guess, holding the liberal seat on the McLaughlin Group on TV, as well as being a Newsweek Washington correspondent. She's a Daily Beast columnist these days and wrote an obit of George H.W. Bush. On economics, David Greenberg, Bush said this, campaigning against Ronald Reagan in the 1980 primaries, about Reagan trickle-down tax cuts for the rich as economics.
What I'm saying is that this type of what I call a voodoo economic policy, it just isn't going to work.
And then Bush signed on when he became Reagan's running mate. What happened there?
Right. So one quick thought. I think the high approval ratings among African Americans was in the immediate wake of the successful, you know, the victory in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War.
When he was like at 80% nationwide overall.
Right. So he was also popular with blacks, but it wasn't necessarily a reflection of those policies.
Okay.
But on voodoo economics, again, there was an older strain of republicanism that it's hard to recall today because the party has moved so far to the right. But it really was very skeptical of Reagan, Jack Kemp, and others who came along saying you can cut taxes, increase defense spending, and you somehow won't increase the deficit. And they were right to be skeptical. And that's what Bush was referring to. And he gave Reagan a good run for his money in the 1980 Republican presidential primaries. But when the call came from Reagan, Reagan wanted to know that Bush would sign on to the whole Reagan platform. And that included the voodoo economics, the supply-side economics. It included giving up his pro-choice or moderate pro-choice position, his support for the Equal Rights Amendment, and other such things. And I think that's the real pivot point in Bush's career.
Can you talk, Eleanor, about that evolution or devolution on abortion rights?
The way that the Bush people explain it is that abortion rights wasn't the central issue then that it is today. It was there were other issues that were driving the election, and that Bush was kind of he didn't exactly give up his positions. He just stepped aside. That he would be out of the loop, which you could actually say, and negotiating his agreement on those two core issues allowed him to join the ticket and to bring with him Jim Baker, who was his campaign manager. And Jim Baker, I would say, is one of the most successful White House chiefs of staff that I've ever seen. And I credit him a lot with the success of Ronald Reagan's presidency. So that was a good bargain. And I think it did, though, begin to create this notion that H.W. Bush would, you know, had no really core positions, that he would, he would put his, I don't know, his manhood in trust with Ronald Reagan in order to gain politically. And that kind of laid the foundation for what Newsweek called the wimp factor. And when Vice President Bush said he was going to run for president in 1988, Newsweek put that on the cover, and it's called Fighting the Wimp Factor. And the cover photo was President Bush at the helm of one of his cigarette boat, looking very virile. And yet, here we had this cover slash, and the Bush people and Bush himself were furious about that. And I think the wimp factor was really more about style than substance. I mean, Bush was this prep school kid. I mean, he played squash, he made himself like pork rinds in that campaign in an effort to be like the people. But he always had this disconnect with sort of regular working people, and with a rising conservatism in the Republican Party that was anti-elitist and anti-country club Republican. And so those two issues, I think they weren't as central then as we are today, but it was key to what Bush would be willing to do in order to attain power.
And that wimp factor, reputation one, led him to the Read My Lips, No New Taxes pledge in the 1988 campaign. We didn't pull that clip. I think people have heard it a million times. But then the policy that he actually enacted when he went back on that in the face of the rising federal deficits, I think many people on, I don't know if it's fair to say on both sides of the aisle, came to think was actually good policy. As he explained it at the time, he got three times as much in spending cuts as he gave up in tax increases. And then everybody looks back fondly today on those mid-90s years when there were federal surpluses instead of deficits.
Without a doubt. So I think, you know, to my mind, listening to this conversation, I think if you boiled it down, you'd say this is someone who at some level was a political pragmatist who believed he could do what he wanted to do in the campaigns, including throw dirty shots and blow the belt, Willie Horton, but then believed in good governance and sort of the good George H.W. Bush would emerge as president. And remember, this is a guy that lost two Senate races in Texas, and he was very sensitive to the idea of playing to that base. The second thing to say is, I think, is expedience. I think that, you know, even in office, even when he was supposedly practicing good governance, if he saw an opportunity, which is the case, I think, with some of the drugs, for example, I think that he thought this is an easy sell to my base and will quiet the Newt Gingrich's, the far right, for a time. and the same thing with Clarence Thomas to some extent. And then you come to George Herbert Walker Bush, who, moving forward, really, I think, saw himself as a public servant, serving the people, but making those decisions himself while putting on the show for the far right. And certainly that's the case with the taxes. Remember, Democrats, as Eleanor pointed out, had the majority of both the House and the Senate, and they bought into the deal, and they thought it was a good deal, and it certainly had a good consequence to the American economy in the 90s.
I want to get each of you briefly, or see which one of you really wants to talk briefly about the first Gulf War, which was controversial going in, as I said at the top of the segment. Eleanor, you write in your obit about his prowess as an internationalist, and obviously Trump is a nationalist, so people are making that comparison right now. But looking back, he also got us into this decade-long policing of Iraq for what many people at the time thought was not enough of a reason. If there was this intra-Arab dispute, Iraq and Kuwait, over, you know, islands that one of them owned or the other of them owned that had a lot of oil wealth, that maybe we didn't have to go in and get ourselves into this decade-long policing of Iraq that started at that time and ended in his son's war. And here we still are with the consequences of that. I mean, honestly, that's one way that I look back on this history, with a not so rosy take on the so-called good Persian Gulf War. David, you have a take on this?
Well, I think the enforcement of the principle of international law about not invading other countries and violating their sovereignty was an important one to defend. And I do also give Bush credit for building an international coalition in support of the mission. But he really didn't resolve the problem because for some reasonable good reason, he didn't want to go to Iraq and remove Saddam Hussein, but it left the problem there. So people forget the second Gulf War was really a result of Saddam Hussein getting rid of the weapons inspectors that were a condition of the ceasefire. It was really what Dick Cheney called unfinished business. The first Gulf War never really ended.
Although really, Eleanor, he's getting a lot of praise in the obits for not having gone all the way to Baghdad and removed Saddam Hussein and killed so many Iraqi troops on the way, and which would have been necessary, and set the U.S. up as an occupier.
Well, I mean, I think he handled the first Gulf War well, and the Democrats in the Senate who voted against it came to regret it because they saw that vote was seen as a positive thing in both political parties. And he did put together extraordinary international support, and I think, didn't the Saudis pay for it? and unlike Trump, who can't seem to get the Mexicans to pay for the wall. And I think what happened with the second Bush, you can get into all the Oedipal stuff, but I think he saw a chance to finish what his father started. But there was really no reason to finish it because Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of nuclear destruction, and that was all kind of exaggerated and made up and all of that. And that's a whole other story. So I don't fault the father in this one.
But I just wanted to add that the international coalition really was effective.
Right.
All right. Yeah. One final topic and then a closing thought. This actually came up, and we mentioned it on yesterday's show, but I'm going to play this clip again. It came up on ABC This Week last Sunday before Bush died, that Alan Dershowitz was on television defending Donald Trump over the possibility that Trump would pardon Paul Manafort or anybody else as a way to keep the investigators off of Trump himself, which sounds like it would be obstruction of justice as a matter of common sense. But Dershowitz looked back to George H.W. Bush and said this.
What
Bush did to Caspar Weinberger is identical. He pardoned on the eve of the trial to avoid criminal investigations. The special prosecutor said that. Walsh said that. Nobody suggested criminal prosecution there.
The difference here would be that he's pardoning to protect himself.
So was Bush. He pardoned to protect himself. The great fear was that Caspar Weinberger would point the finger back at him. Don't believe me on this. Believe Lawrence Wolf.
Almost forgotten to history, David Greenberg, that George H.W. Bush pardoned Reagan's defense secretary, Caspar Weinberger, in the Iran-Contra scandal to stop an investigation of Bush himself.
Well, and Dershowitz is right in that they're very parallel. I think he's wrong in saying we shouldn't be exercised about the prospect of Trump doing the same thing. To my mind, what Bush did there, you know, and after having said he was out of the loop in Iran-Contra, the famous quote that Eleanor reminded us of in a different context, you know, was given the lie by Weinberger's diaries and by Bush's own diaries that threatened to come to light. So this really was a very self-protective mechanism. And, you know, to my mind, far worse than lies Clinton told or lots of other presidents tell, because it was kind of done on the way out the door, also, I think, by a president who had lost, who had been as resoundingly rejected by the American people since any incumbent since Herbert Hoover. People sort of, they dwelled on it for a couple of days. It was around Christmas time, and it was gone. But it should be a major element of how we remember him.
And one final Bush clip. This is him in 2012 with Diane Sawyer on ABC. Asked if the Republican Party in the Tea Party era had become too right-wing.
Jeb said recently that he worries about the Republican Party and the polarization.
Well, I think that's true in some context. I mean, it gets so locked in and so right, and it troubles me a little bit. But overall, I don't feel that way.
Overall, he didn't feel that way. Now, that wasn't during Trump, but it was at the height of the Tea Party when a kind of similar conversation was breaking out. Eleanor, a final thought about Bush's legacy with respect to moderation?
Well, he in a book, he referred to Dick Cheney, who was his son's vice president, as a real hard ass. And there was some sense that the father was blaming Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld for the invasion of Iraq that had gone bad. And yet, Dick Cheney points out that he heard from the senior Bush soon after that and said, "Dick, I did it. I said it." And Cheney now wears the label hard ass very proudly. And the new movie that's coming out, Cheney, I guess it's called Vice, where Christian Bale plays him. Cheney said in a panel over last weekend that his 18-year-old granddaughter saw the film and said, "You're a real badass. Cool."
Well, George H.W. Bush was a more complicated politician than many of the remembrances are acknowledging in the media, but he did seem to care about people and his country and even the world, at least as he saw it. And may he rest in peace. And we thank Rutgers historian David Greenberg, author of Republic of Spin and an article in Politico this week called "Is History Being Too Kind to George H.W. Bush?" Eleanor Cliff, Daily Beast, Washington correspondent, who wrote an obit, and Juan Williams, Fox News political analyst and author of the new book, "What Have You Got to Lose? What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights." Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New York City Council Speaker Cory Johnson, and a lot to talk about next.